the New World Report. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute, Columbia. The Reuters quote is provocative. This from Gustavo Petro, the first-term president of Colombia. I believe you can only run one at a time unless, in any event, the quote is, "I want him alive," says Petro of a rebel leader. What rebel leader, I thought to myself. This is the top leader of a Estado Mayor Central, EMC. Professor, I get lost. There's so many gangs. There's so many top leaders who then disappear. I don't recall EMC easily. But in any event, Petro, who had grand plans to make peace with the rebels, saying that they were expressing the discontent of the nation, is now very much mano a mano with a man whom I'm unfamiliar with, but he leads a top leader of a rebel group that won't make peace. What's happened to Petro?
Well, John, Petro's attempt at what he called total peace, which was going to be about relaxing activities against all of the major groups, both with leftist guerrilla ties as well as criminal groups, and trying in different ways to get each of them to reduce violence. Each of those in different ways is fallen apart for different reasons. And a little bit of the background, of course, historically you had two major leftist guerrilla groups that were fighting in Colombia prior to 2016. The bigger of which was the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or the FARC, and a smaller, more Maoist oriented group, the ELN. What happened you had a series of different armed groups who were just involved in narco trafficking, the biggest of which at the time was the Urabeños. 2016, you had a peace deal, a relatively flawed deal that was designed to take the FARC off the table. They partially demobilized, but then things started to get really complicated. Some of the FARC that demobilized actually went into the hands of the ELN. Others went into the hands of the narcos, the narco groups split, etc. And so when Petro came in pursuing peace with all of the fragments of these groups, it became even more complicated. And so where you're at right now is that the ELN, you have a partial peace accord, which is in the process of really falling apart because the ELN is relatively split up. What used to be the FARC, you have two groups. One of the groups that basically continued doing narco trafficking activities, they used to call them the FARC dissidents. They now basically call them the FARC general staff, the Estado Mayor Conjunto, under a gentleman by the name of Ivan Mordisco. They're still on the field, also a remnants of the FARC that had gone to the peace table and then decided that it wasn't for them and went back out into the field, a group called the Segundo Marquetalia. They are also in negotiations with the government. So it was that one of those remnants of the FARC, the most powerful and in narco affiliated one, with which Petro was trying to pursue one of his different peace deals. They had a ceasefire that initially was going to be till this January. It was extended until July. But as it turned out, the groups essentially continued to conduct activity in the places where they weren't supposed to. In Nariño and Cauca and Valle de Cauca, there was attacks against indigenous communities in the area. And so about a week ago, the government said, okay, no more of this. You violated the provisions of the accord. We're going after you. The latest in this drama was Petro's very personal statement that you referred to, that he said, don't kill the leader, Ivan Mordisco. Let's bring him in for questioning in jail because we want to talk to him, which, again, is a little bit of political theater. But the broader context is just to show how this attempt by total peace with various different armed groups continues to unravel. And what you have is the continuing explosion of cocaine production, the continuing violence in the Colombian countryside, competition and uncertainty, the continuing flood of the country with drug money. And in many ways, Colombia is back into a situation which is worse than it was in the 1990s, when people in the U.S. security establishment were evaluating Colombia as being on the verge of being a failed narco state.
It would also be a recommendation to future politicians not to start your life as a member of a violent rebel gang, as Petro did, because it weakens your irony later on in life. We turn to Ecuador. This also is a puzzle because there is another assassination, this time of a young woman who is the youngest mayor in the country. I note that Daniel Noboa, the new president, is very young as well. So this is a blow against the well-to-do middle class of Ecuador, a troubled nation. However, the twist here is her name is Garcia, or was Garcia, Brigitte Garcia. She was found shot to death with her driver on a Sunday morning. The twist is she was the mayor of a town called San Vicente, and the report in Reuters is that that is linked to Correa, the former dictator who's been in exile, I believe, in Europe for some time, and was seen as a malevolent factor in the recent election, where there were assassinations of a mayor on the coast and of a presidential candidate. So what does this tell us about Ecuador? It's all against all? Is that it, Professor?
Well, things are actually getting better in Ecuador, John, but it really is an illustration of what a mess you have and the interdependence of the different messes. And so recalling that Ecuador is basically just to the southwest of Colombia. And so it was Ecuador used to be a relatively peaceful and has always been a relatively democratic, institutionally fairly well-governed country. But as more and more of the Colombian narco groups began with the help of Mexicans to export their goods through Ecuador, through places like Esmeraldas and in Manta and in Manabí, working with the local gangs, one group that called themselves the Choneros. Later, there was a split. There was another one of the local gangs called Los Lobos, et cetera, et cetera. That led to an explosion of gang violence, which impacted the previous government, contributed to the fall of the government last year of Guillermo Lasso, among other things, and led to the new government that we have of Daniel Noboa, the son of a very wealthy banana magnate in Ecuador. So in the middle of that, basically one of the things that Noboa was forced to do was implement a state of emergency, deploy the military, declare 22 groups, these armed groups as terrorist organizations. That was just extended. And frankly, it has restored a lot of temporary peace. Violence is, at least homicides are relatively down, although it's said that extortions are still significant. But as we saw with the murder of Brigitte Garcia, the mayor of the community near Manabí, it is, there still continues to be violence. And as we saw, again, because of the character of that region of Ecuador, it happens that that's a very leftist affiliated place, affiliated with Rafael Correa's Citizen Revolution, Revolución Ciudadana movement. And so you see it basically on both the right and left. The local politicians are getting essentially impacted by the settling of scores, and the violence goes on. But at least to a certain degree, Ecuador is really trying to get a handle on this violence, and at least little by little for the moment, although it's still playing out, there are some reasons to hope that things are moving toward the better, at least slowly.
One more example of for my friends everything, for my enemies the law. This is a mystery. The Mexican Texas border, the Mexican border with the U.S., where the crisis is now at a level that I can't describe, people surging across desperate. It's as if they're piling into a lifeboat. There's fear among the migrants who come through the Darien Gap and cross all of Central America and find a way across the Rio Grande. At the same time, Mexico knows that it has the authority, the resources, the apparatus to slow the flow or stop it entirely at the southern Mexican border. And yet, and in remarks in 60 Minutes by the outgoing president, López Obrador, AMLO, there was a blunt challenge to the U.S. We'll permit you to return people who've crossed into the United States without documents if you give us, and then a list of demands that seemed impossible. One of them, providing citizenship to any Mexican citizen living in the United States without documents. Another had to do with lifting sanctions on Venezuela. Another had to do with lifting the embargo on Cuba. Professor, is there an easy way to say what AMLO's up to? Why was he making demands this late in his, what appears to be successful administration of his neighbor to the north?
Well, John, like a long but bad marriage, there's a lot of history here. And, you know, the history of, you know, U.S. interventions in, you know, Mexico, you know, the, you know, civil war with Texas, you know, a range of different things, you know, Pershing's punitive expeditions. But in more contemporary days, certainly, you know, the question in Mexico, whether the drugs flowing from through Mexico creating the level of violence that we've seen since the you know, the days of President Felipe Calderon and before, you know, to what degree is, you know, U.S. demand versus you know, Mexico's you know, corruption and narco groups to blame? To what degree is the availability of guns from the U.S. to blame? So in the relationship, there's long been a lot of finger pointing, and a part of that finger pointing has to do with migration policies. The U.S., of course, complaining about the you know, Mexico's often unwillingness to control the flow of migrants, or at least wanting Mexico to do more. And again, when I worked under Secretary Pompeo during the Trump administration, we saw that the same type of things, wanting to get Mexico to work with us to control those flows across its southern border and through Mexico, and not just allow everyone to present themselves on the U.S. southern border, and yet Mexico taking offense at U.S. efforts to try to bully or criticize it. So I think what you heard from AMLO, who always kind of spontaneously speaks his mind, is a little bit of this. And the historic Mexican argument is, well, if you would just do more to create economic opportunity here in the region, if you would just take better care of the Mexicans in the United States who, you know, have uncertain citizenship status, then, you know, we can all work together here. And so what you have on really on both sides are difficult demands. But the part of it most recently had come from the U.S. complaint of just the level of a lack of cooperation, both on drugs, but also on migration coming through Mexico. And again, I think AMLO trying to push back with what have really been kind of stock answers about you know, the need for more money for development, the need for taking better care of Mexican migrants. And certainly within the U.S. Congress, you had, I think, some very strong pushback on that message and the unrealistic nature of that. But again, you know, long bad marriage, but one where there's a high level of interdependence. You know, it very vitally important with these two economies, bound by geography and bound by you know, trade and in commerce, is best seen through you know, the USMCA agreement and supply chain interdependence. Vitally important for Mexico, despite the history, to find ways to work together for our economic benefit as well as for our security and common problems.
Professor Evan Ellis, U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute. We're headed to Buenos Aires, Argentina, where there is a very excited new president, Javier Milei. And everybody's watching very carefully about his extreme ideas, radical ideas, fresh ideas, to solve the quandary of the Argentinian economy, which is collapsing on inflation and despair. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.